Wednesday, December 21st, and this is Geek Nights. Tonight we talk about anime, Big O 2, and Space Symphony My Tao.
Let's do this!
So today at work, one of my coworkers came into my office with a box of some sort of card. Like, a card for a computer. And they looked real old. And he looked at me and he asked me what they were. And I didn't know. And they were kind of weird. They were these large, like super large, before the days of PCI or EISA. And there were two cards, and they were connected by this ribbon cable between the two. And they had a coax coming out of them. And then another coworker appeared, and he's like, oh, that's Token Bus. And finally, a piece of legendary computing that I never really understood came together, and I finally, for the first time, saw an actual Token Bus.
Not a token ring.
No, not a token ring.
A token bus.
A token bus.
I've heard of such a thing, but I've never actually seen it or known how it worked.
You see, what happened was, I remember in all my history of computing classes at RIT, we learned, like, Ethernet and all the different kinds of Ethernet and PCNet and token ring. And I remember our textbook had a little blurb, like one paragraph, and it said, like, token bus. And all it said was token bus was similar to token ring in that it used token passing, but was completely different in other ways, and it is beyond the scope of this book.
All right. So
we asked the professor, and he was like, it's beyond the scope of this class. It's alien. It's utterly alien, and it's not used by anyone.
But you had it.
Well, it was used mostly by factories. I mean, basically, to get into a very, very brief history of the internet, there are two ways to connect computers together on a fundamental level. There are statistical networking methods, and there are deterministic networking methods. Token ring, token bus, all those things are deterministic. You can calculate exactly how much latency there'll be between different machines. Machines can't talk unless they get a little token or something, so everything's very deterministic, and collisions don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Ethernet was statistical, meaning they expect an amount of collisions, but statistically, in the long run, they expect most of the data to get through despite that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very chaotic, and they expected that through the chaos, the data would get through somehow.
All right.
And IBM backed deterministic methods, and other people like Xerox backed other methods, and eventually Ethernet won, and that's what we use today almost exclusively.
What are you going to do with these token bus cards?
They're probably going to be thrown away. I'll see if they'll give me one to take home and put on display.
You should send them to the museum to put them next to ENIAC.
I said they should donate them to RIT, so next time a kid asks what the hell token bus is, the professor can be like, it's this!
They'll just put them on the wall in the lab as decoration. Send them to a museum. Museums are where it
needs to go. But actually, token bus is kind of cool, now that I know exactly what it was. And I'm not going to bore you with the details, but it is basically a super, super, super deterministic real-time way of doing networking that was used in a lot of factories back in the day. GM was a big proponent of it.
All right.
It was used to control robots in factories, and now it is used for nothing.
That's cool.
Yeah?
I always like old technology bits.
Me too. So that's why it's fun working at IBM. I find all this old, busted crap like in back warehouses, and I get to fiddle with it.
You should go find it and destroy it and replace it with new stuff.
It's not even being used. It's just, like, in boxes.
Wow. Just wow.
Yeah.
I wonder how much space and how much money it costs IBM to have all this old, useless crap just taking up room. And
considering that they own more warehouse space than they need, and they own large buildings with plenty of extra space, and every now and then that stuff comes in handy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool.
All right. So, speaking of computer hardwares, the number one hard drive manufacturer in the world, Seagate, who I also happen to think is the best hard drive manufacturer in the world, has purchased for $1.9 billion the third largest hard drive manufacturer in the world, which is Maxdor. Which I would say makes the second best hard drives in the world.
Western Digital is number two.
Yeah, they make the second most number, but I don't think they're good.
Well, actually, it was funny. I was looking on the Slashdot article and the comments about this, mm-hmm. and there were several people who said, Western Digital is fantastic, and I've never had one die. We use them in all our servers, blah, blah, blah.
It's just statistics, man.
Yeah.
It's not actually that those are worse, but I've had like two or three WDs die, and I've had Seagate. I've never seen a Seagate crash except for this really old 20-megabyte one, which doesn't count.
Yeah. See, I guess you really can't listen to geeks when it comes to that kind of hard drive thing, because basically, hard drives crash. All of them.
And depending on what geek you talk to, they'll have a different brand crash on them.
Yep.
And they will be loyal to another brand based solely on which brand crashed and which brand did not.
Yeah, because the first hard drive I ever had that crashed was a Western Digital, and I haven't had a Western Digital since. But my most recent hard drive's crash was this Maxtor that I'm holding in my hand right now. It still has data on it, but I can't get the data.
Yep, I've seen his Maxtor crash. I've had WDs that crashed. And I've had Seagate's never crash. So that's the only reason I'm loyal to Seagate is randomness, basically.
Well, and they give you the seashell.
Oh, the seashell is great because, oh my god, oh yeah.
It's this little plastic thing that you can stick a hard drive in and it pretty much makes it invincible.
Yep. No, all the other hard drive manufacturers, they don't give you crap. They just give you the hard drive and maybe like a piece of plastic or a static bag or something.
Yeah.
The seashell is very nice and patented by Seagate.
But I wonder if there are going to be any ramifications of this merger. I mean, monopoly?
Y'all, definitely monopoly is one thing to worry about. However, I don't see them not keeping up hard drive technology. They'll continue to improve hard drive technology, so I'm not worried about that. Not like Microsoft's monopoly where they stagnated software innovation because, you know, oh, we don't need to improve IE, we have monopoly. The other worry is price increases because they can basically screw you because where else are you going to go to get your hard drive?
Well, you know what? We'll go to Western Digital if that's
the case.
Yeah,
if Seagate makes the prices way too high, like, oh, ho, ho, for our new drives, we will charge a bajillion dollars. I really will buy a WD. And
yeah, though the thing is with hard drives is, one, it's a real low-margin market.
Mm-hmm.
They don't make so much profit per drive because it's a really competitive market. And if you slip at all, a Chinese manufacturer will appear and just destroy you.
See, my worry here, the place I can see it going wrong, is let's say Seagate comes out with some new awesome hard drive technology because they have so many labs and things now, right? And the good research. And they patent it, and they're the only ones who have it. And because they're so big, they push it to be the standard.
Luckily.
And then they screw us because, the only place you can get the awesome hard drives with this technology is from us, and we will charge more money than usual.
See, the thing is, a standard like that doesn't mean anything because, I mean, all different hard drives are pretty much completely different internally. They use different mechanisms and different algorithms, different chips, and they're all pretty crazy. And the only commonality is that on the end of them, there is a little thing that is serial ATA or IDE or SCSI.
I'm not talking about the connector. I don't think we'll have a worry about.
So if they don't, the thing is, currently the hard drive manufacturers do that anyway. Maxtor has this special technology that they can make the drives quiet or fast or whatever.
Oh yeah, yeah. But I'm talking about all of those are just mostly like marketing talk things. Like, oh, ours has feature XYZ, which is just these little marketing labels that they say theirs is better. I'm worried about them actually making something where their drives just wipe the floor with everyone else.
Yeah, there's not really much you could do without changing the interface as well as just the drive.
Yeah. Well, Hitachi actually has that perpendicular thing going on.
Yeah, well, that's partly because Hitachi bought IBM's hard drive division not so long ago.
Oh, well.
Hard drive market has been consolidating rapidly for the last 5 years.
So what happens when margins are low is you buy up the other guy.
Yeah.
But I heard that Hitachi, this is a rumor, even if it's not a rumor, I only saw one sentence, so don't hold me to this.
Rumor monger.
But I saw it said Hitachi is working on or releasing a, what was it, like a 5 terabyte hard drive?
Oh, I saw that. I don't know.
I think if they're using the perpendicular technology, I might believe it, because basically right now, this is really, really dumb and non-technological, the way I'm going to say this. Because actually, I don't really understand it myself so much, but the zeros and the ones in the hard drive are lying flat. Perpendicular technology is where they all stand up in a row. Now, if you think about zeros and ones lying flat on a disk, as to them standing up on a disk, you can fit a lot more if they're all standing up. That's what perpendicular is.
To put it in a slightly more scientific light, because that kind of hurt a little.
Yeah, it hurt me too.
Basically, data density is increasing. And there have been a lot of reasons for that. But basically, older drives, the bits are longer on the drive just because that's the resolution of bits. Like, imagine a CD. There's little pits on it. It's the same basic deal, only it's magnetic bits instead.
And they're not uniform in their shape. They're rectangular.
And they've been making them smaller and smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember it was a year or two ago when you might have heard about the magic pixie dust. And it was a technology where they put a dust of magnetic pseudo material on hard drives internally, and then you could get higher data density, stuff like that. So this perpendicular technology is really just a means of making the bits on the drive smaller, like physically smaller, but still able to be read and verified. I don't know exactly how they do it, because hard drive manufacturers are incredibly secretive about their trade secrets and technology.
Just imagine a bunch of people lying on the ground, right? There's 20 feet. It's a 20.
I think everyone gets it.
All right, fine. We'll forget it then. Well, if you need a further explanation, there's actually a cute flash video Hitachi put out. You can search for.
Or we'll link to it.
Yeah, just type in like perpendicular flash video or something into Google. You should find it.
Yep. Well, the thing about hard drives is not only are the margins low, but the prices are generally very constant. The speed, the size and speed just increase over time. So, like, a lot of people think, oh, I'll buy a cheapo 40-gigabyte hard drive for nothing. But then you look, and the 40-gigabyte hard drives aren't really any cheaper than the 180-gigabyte hard drives.
There's no real reason right now to buy a hard drive less than 80 gigs.
Yeah.
It's just a waste of money. And really, you can get 120 for maybe $5-$10 more sometimes.
But don't think they're ripping you off. Basically, it's just that it costs the same. Once you figure out how to make a 400-gigabyte hard drive, it costs almost the same to make one 400-gigabyte one as it does to make one 40-gigabyte one.
Yeah, I mean, a hard drive is a motor, which costs the same no matter what, as long as it's the same speed and power.
Yep, the platters that are very similarly manufactured.
Yep, they're just platters. And then there's a circuit board, which is mostly the same price no matter what. And the case it goes, you put all the pieces together in, which is the same price no matter what. So the only difference is how many platters and what type of platter they are. If they're higher density platters cost more, and having four platters instead of three or two costs more. So that's really the only difference. So an 80 gig drive might have like two 40 gig platters or three like 20 something gig platters. You know, and if you compare that to a 100 gig drive, which might just have two or three platters, it's not much price difference. It's, you know, so that's how it works.
Yeah, so we'll see what comes of this merger.
Mm-hmm.
Though in other extremely esoteric computer geek news, X11R7. So, I'll warn you right now that if you're not very technical, we're sorry about this next short segment.
Just fast forward.
Yeah.
So in Linux, when you want a GUI, use the X window system. And if you use Unix or Linux, you know this.
It's pretty universal.
Yeah, and until very recently, you were using X386. Now, and we just switched to Xorg because X386 changed their license, and now Xorg is better and actually improving X. And before Xorg, X-Free wasn't really improving X at all. They were just pretty much making X and incrementally bug fixing and doing small performance enhancements. They weren't adding features or actually trying to go anywhere. But people kept using it because that's what it was, and no one was competing with them. And it pretty much stayed that way for 10 years. For almost 10 years, X386 just had X11R6, and it was just stagnant, unchanging. That's why GUIs in Linux still really suck.
Yep, because it's really hard to do things with X in certain cases. It's very obtuse and
yeah, it is bleh. But now,
like,
finally...
That's not even like... That's like people who know a lot about it say that, too.
Yeah, it also had a lot of inherent problems with its design, and then they used a lot of hacks over the years to cover them up. Like, it was just inherently insecure, you wanted it to have this feature where it was network transparent. And that sort of conflicted, so they just kind of hacked at it until they made it fake secure. Anyway, since Xorg took over, they've actually been working on it. So now, finally, today, they released the final official version of X11R7, which is going to screw a lot of people up because they have that USR X11R6 folder. Yeah. And right, the way it works is it's modular. So now the parts that you want, you have, and the parts that you don't want, you don't have. And everything that used to suck before now works in either an awesome way or at least a nicer way. Especially things like mouses.
Yeah, I mean, there were issues. I used some crap old Red Hat boxes at work, and I had to reconfigure X because certain mice that, I mean, standard PS2 mice just fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
They would crash X, and I had to do some hackish things to make them not crash X.
I mean, it used to be, I remember when I first was using Linux 4 or 5 years ago, you couldn't make a USB mouse work just by putting it in. I mean, and even today, if you don't configure it right, you know, things don't, the mouse might not work, or you might unplug the mouse, plug it back in, and it won't work. It's crazy.
Now, I just saw this while we were talking. I was looking through the article on this. And some guy named SimHacker on Slashdot has probably the most succinct description of X that I've ever seen.
All right.
X Windows is the Iran-Contra of graphical user interfaces, a tragedy of political compromises, entangled alliances, marketing hype, and greed. X Windows is to memory as Ronald Reagan is to money. It goes on and on like that. So props to this guy. That's pretty.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, anyone who's using some Leet Awesome distribution like Gentoo or something will have X11R7 within days, probably.
Yeah. And if you've got Red Hat, you're never going to get it. Don't even...
Yeah, if you're using Fedora, you're going to be waiting a few months to get it.
Honestly, if you're using Fedora, you're probably better off not upgrading.
You're very better off using Ubuntu.
Or if you're going to use this, you're going to have to pretty much wipe out your system.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there'll be a how-to in a few days and some RPMs, like, here's how to do it, but it won't work for everyone, it won't work in all cases, and, you know, but pretty much what it comes down to is I'm willing to bet that Gentoo will have it working first, but they'll have a few problems with the people who go for it real early, and Ubuntu will be and Debian will be the first people to have it working reliably and awesomely. And I'm really looking forward to it because it's going to make, I think it's going to make a jump in the usability of Linux as big as the 2.6 kernel made.
If it actually does all that's promised and it works and people are able to extend and modify and enhance, this could be really awesome.
Yeah.
Like this could be one of the factors that we really need to get Linux out there on the desktop to non-geeks.
Mm-hmm. I remember when the 2.4 kernel was when I started using Linux, and it was kind of pain. Well, I technically used older kernels than that, but 2.4 was the first kernel I really interacted with.
2.4 was the first kernel where I knew what a kernel was and what it did.
And, you know, it wasn't great for desktoping. It was just kind of like a mess. And then 2.6 made everything. It was just leaps and bounds ahead in terms of greatness. I completely forget a lot of 2.4 because I use 2.6 so much now, and it's so great. And I'm hoping X11R7 does the same thing, and it probably will.
All right, so my thing of the day, gamers have bad posture.
I do.
And gamers... And I'm no exception. I remember when I was a young kid playing, like, Final Fantasy, you know, 1. You'd pretty much sit there hunched over with the controller, just kind of in the state of bleh, for hours and hours and hours on end.
I did.
Didn't you ever want to prop your chin up on something or kind of, like, prop your body up on something?
No, what I wanted to do was lay down on my back. That's what I... And with, like, my head resting on a pillow. But I could never get a video game close enough to my bed until, like, Game Boys and DSs and those sorts of things came
out. Well, luckily, science has made advances in this field.
Hooray!
I mean, we have the video rockers, which we have and are awesome.
Awesome.
And now there's the head pillow. It's sold in Japan. I don't know if it's coming to the U.S. or not. I imagine it will. Basically, it looks like a video rocker, but just the back end, and it sits on your lap, and it's positioned in such a way that it holds your chin and head up, but yet your arms can still get around it.
Uh-huh.
You'll have to look at the picture in the link. It's both cool and sad at the same time.
Yeah, that's pretty much the exact thing you get by looking at it. So, I'm sure everyone knows about Bimani games, which are... You know, in the Beatmania series from Konami and other similar rhythm games.
Dance, Dance Revolution.
You know, or, you know, the game, play the guitar and push the buttons to the beat, or dance to the beat, or wave your hands to the beat.
And we are going to do a show on DDR at some point. It's been requested by two people, so hang in there.
All right, and there is one current existing game called Taiko Drum Master, which is a beat game where you bang on a taiko drum.
Yeah, I always wanted to play it because it looks really cool.
Yeah, but anyway, I never played it, but I do know of it and I've seen it. It has these cute little drum guys who are all happy and everything. And I'm sure that everyone in Japan is just elite master of this game, but it's the first time on the internet that I've seen video of someone playing the hardest songs in the game perfectly.
You know what? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen lots of DDR videos, and they're usually impressive because someone dances in an interesting way or something. This is just a guy playing the game boringly. Now, I expected to be impressed by some crazy-ass drumming, but I watched the first song, and it was pretty lame. Like, I'm like, I could do that with a little bit of practice. It's not hard at all.
Yeah, I mean, back in high school, I was a trumpet player, but I, like, did some set drumming on the side. Like, I wasn't very good. I'm not even going to pretend that I was a good drummer. But I played a set drum for some pet band, and pretty much the hardest song in the game, as far as I can tell, is, like, basic snare drumming.
Yep. But the second song was significantly more impressive in its difficulty. While, you know, it would actually take me a little while before I would be able to do it as well as that guy did. But at the same time, it's still not nearly as crazy as some of the DDR things are.
Yeah, I mean, even some of the moderately difficult DDR songs are insane compared to this.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's still cool to watch, especially the second song, if you've never seen Taiko Drum Master, or if you want to know what it looks like when someone scores perfectly on the hardest song.
Nah.
I thought it was cool.
It was all right.
Yep.
So today being Anime Day and Comic Day, we've been watching Big O 2. We just saw the first episode of Space Symphony Mytel, which is part of that whole Mytel Harlock saga that's complicated.
Galaxy Express, really.
Yeah. And then we got some comics.
Mm-hmm.
So Big O, I talked about back in the Scottless show quite some time ago. It's a good show. And I'm not going to spoil anything, but suffice to say, the end of Big O is unsatisfying.
That's putting it lightly.
By unsatisfying, imagine if suddenly, in about 25 seconds worth of episode, they introduce a whole shit ton of plot, and then a crazy thing happens, and then the episode just stops, and that's the end of the whole show.
Yep, that was the 13th episode of Big O 1.
So you'll be pleased to know that Big O 2 starts up right there. Like, exactly where the first show ended.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's really a 26-episode show, and they just call the second 13... I think Big O 2 is 13 episodes, isn't it?
I think so.
They just call the second 13 episodes Big O 2 because the show originally ended after the 13th, and then Cartoon Network had to pay them to make more.
Yep. Though the one thing that I gotta say, Big O 2 definitely has plot this time.
Yeah, Big O 1, some of the episodes were sort of episodic in that they didn't matter to the plot, and a lot of things are real vague. And Big O 2 certainly isn't straightforward by any means.
But it's much, much, much more straightforward.
Yeah, but it's like, you know when an anime, and they always have like, it's the whole effect of the guy in white. Remember the Simpsons episode where there's the guy in white and he hasn't done anything?
This is the episode where the Mafia and the Chinese Triad are fighting with each other. Or the Yakuza, I forget. It was something like that.
On the front lawn of the Simpsons house. And Homer's like, oh, I know when he hasn't done anything and he looks different than the other guys. So I know when he does something, it's going to be awesome.
And Marge is like, get in the house, Homer.
And then as soon as he closes the door, you hear like, wow! And he's like, oh, I missed it. Well, when you watch an anime, there's usually like some big bad guys who are all secretive or mysteries that aren't revealed, right? And then towards the end, they start to do more and more things that make you go, oh my God, there's the thing. Oh my God, it was a secret that is now revealed, right? Well, Big O 2 is pretty much just, they really step it up in terms of that kind of stuff. It's like, oh, there's a guy. Oh, the main secretive guy is talking a lot, and he's a major part of the plot. Oh, we actually get to see all kinds of stuff that used to just be in the background and sort of implied and mysterious.
Yep.
You know?
Like, in the first one, like, you really weren't sure what was going on. Like, Rosewater, who was kind of this, like, the head of Paradigm City.
You only saw him talk, like, four times.
And he'd say some offhand thing, but everything he said was like, oh! Huh.
Yep.
Now, he's just like a main character. He's talking all the time. He explains in great detail, like, very obscure plot points that you've been wondering about forever.
Mm.
The problem is, for everything they reveal, they introduce two or three more mysteries.
Yeah, like, there's this new bad guy who's all evil, and you know he's a bad guy. He's got a kind of a Kefka attitude. But they don't tell you jack about him other than you know he's bad and you know you got
to
get rid of him.
Yep, and he seems to be working for Rosewater there. But yep. I don't know if it's going to be a Kefka where there's betrayal or what.
The other thing they do is there's a lot of recurring going on. Like, there were episodes that you thought were just kind of bleh before, like the ones with the little seat, the diving guys. But now the diving guys reappear, and it's like recurring things, meaning
yep. recurring and explained. Like, oh, okay, that's what they were doing.
Yep.
Like, remember that episode? Again, we're really avoiding spoilers here. But when there's the girl and she has the red balloon, mm-hmm. she lets go of it and it flies away, and they keep like focused on this red balloon, but they don't explain it.
You think it's just like a metaphor or a symbol of something
that comes back twice in the first four episodes of Big O 2, and the second time you're like, oh, that makes perfect sense now.
Yeah, now I know what the red balloon is. It actually means something physical, not just kind of a symbol.
Yeah, it's very much a literal physical event. It is not just metaphor.
Yep. It's pretty cool when stuff like that happens. And you only catch it if you're paying attention. If you watch the show lazily, you'll miss a lot of stuff.
Yeah, like Big O1, you can get away with that. Because, all right, now the robots are fighting. Woo. Oh, we punched him real hard. Big O 2, everything means something.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least means something in the sense that if you've ever seen the later episodes of Utena, it gets to the point where things mean something but you're not sure, and it might just like be... It's hard to explain. Some things are silly. Mm-hmm. Like there's this tomato thing going on.
Tomato thing makes sense in Big O.
It makes sense in Big O, but it is definitely a metaphor.
It's definitely a metaphor.
It's an obvious metaphor where things turn into tomatoes and everyone's always eating tomatoes and there's tomatoes everywhere.
Yep.
And if you think I'm exaggerating, no. Roger Smith wakes up in a pile of tomatoes at one point.
Yep. Anyway, the other cool thing about Big O 2 is the robot reveals a lot more of its powers.
Yes.
In Big O 1, pretty much all it does is punch, and it has, I think it used the eye laser a couple times.
Once it used the missile.
Once it used the missiles, but just once. And then I think he might have used the metal hooks once.
Yeah.
In Big O 2, he uses like a bunch of metal hooks and a bunch of guns and all kinds of crazy weaponry on the robot that he never used before.
Because in Big O 1, you notice how whenever he fought someone, it was someone where just there was no chance. He was just going to win no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
In Big O 2, he's fighting things that are as dangerous, if not more dangerous, than the Big O.
Yep.
The Big O takes damage, loses arms, gets parts of it blown off.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Now, the one thing I wonder is, we've seen the first DVD of Big O 2, and almost everything from Big O 1, no matter how minor it was, is now coming back into Big O 2 and being explained and is usually really important.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm wondering is, was that intended from the beginning, or did they go through those episodes and decide, all right, let's take this and make it mean this, let's take this and do this with it?
Well, if it's the second one, they did a really good job.
Yeah.
There's one way to find out, and I think reading the manga might reveal the truth.
Of course. I'm also wondering if they just made up a bunch of stuff, and then when they ran out of stuff to make up, they tried to do something with what they had. Because we watched we read one of the interviews with the guy who made Big O. And basically, he got the idea. Big O spawned in his head when he decided he wanted a guy like Batman to pilot a big robot in a city like Gotham.
Mm-hmm.
That is all Big O started as.
Yep. Actually, it also has a little bit of Mega Man. I think one of the artists is a Mega Man artist.
Ah.
And also, I watched like the first couple episodes of Steam Detectives. And Steam Detectives and Big O, I mean, you can't say that Big O didn't steal anything just out of hand from Steam Detectives. Just look at the coat that the main character of Steam Detectives wears and the buttons on it, and compare it to Roger Smith's coat. And the fact that there's big robots, you're just done right there. That's it.
Now, there's one episode. Was it the first episode, I think?
I don't remember.
There's a weird episode.
That was the first one.
Yeah. Like, it picks up with the action, but there's this weird episode. And to bring up just Utena again, it's very Utena-esque.
Very.
It was a very, like, super metaphoric, strange episode.
End of Ava-esque.
Yes, End of Ava, very much. And all I have to say about that is that when you see it and you're wondering what the fuck, we also thought what the fuck, so don't worry.
Hopefully, by the end of Big O as a whole, that will be sealed up and you will understand at least what half of that means. But I don't know, because I haven't seen that far.
Yeah, honestly, if Big O 2 doesn't explain enough, like there's a threshold of an amount of things I want explained, I'm going nuts and killing Scott.
Great.
So, Mytel Legend, Harlock, and all that.
Yep.
We got the first episode, like I said, of Space Symphony Mytel, and we watched it, and it's really cool.
Yep. It reminds me a lot of, well, all the other Galaxy Express shows.
I mean, it's a really hard series to sink your teeth into. It's real complicated. The timeline's convoluted. It's hard to tell where it starts and ends or what's going on. A lot of the characters look similar. It's really super stylized.
Well, it's in the same style that all of that guy's stuff is in. Why can't I remember his name now? But he's the same guy who did all the Galaxy Expresses, all the Harlocks, Interstellar 555, Battleship Yamato, all those things. And all his stuff is, people are drawn the same way. They're kind of wavy, I guess.
Yeah, but real, like, take the Bishonen, like the old school Bishonen, very tall, very thin, and take it to an extreme.
Yeah, it's like this unique anime style that's like, it's definitely anime, but it's like, it's as if the old anime style of like Tezuka was taken in a different direction as opposed to the direction that all the other anime went in, which is the direction that Lotus War took them in.
I mean, character designs are very unrealistic and very stylized, but there's a lot of depth of emotion and cool things you can do with these characters as a result.
Mm-hmm. And the plots are very space epic, which is very lacking around in general. So if you like space epic, you got to watch all these things and figure out what order to put them in. And
yep,
it's great.
So Space Symphony Mytel is basically, as far as we can tell, the second thing in the chronological timeline.
In the chronological timeline of Galaxy Express. See, this Galaxy Express and Harlock seems to be separate, but sometimes Harlock appears in the Galaxy Express. It's the same universe. So, like, sometimes his plot kind of intertwines with the Galaxy Express plot, but it's not the same thing. Captain Harlock is a story of a space pirate, and Galaxy Express is the story of the cyborg people, you see? And sometimes Harlock interferes.
Yeah, if we did our research, we could probably do a whole show just trying to explain this.
Yeah, but the Galaxy Express order, as I can tell from information on the internet, is Mytel Legend is the first, this is the second thing. There is something else that is not yet made, but the Japanese website says coming soon, September 2005, so don't ask me about that. And then comes the Galaxy Express movies, 1, 2, 3, 4, but the Galaxy Express TV show comes before the Galaxy Express first movie.
So as for this specific one, Space Symphony Mytel, it's kind of modern in terms of there's definitely some CG going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of recently made, and my first impression is that it's very good, and I want to see more of it.
Yeah, the original Galaxy Express movie was, like, one of the first animes I ever saw.
Yeah, because it was on that Sci-Fi Channel thing.
It was on the Sci-Fi Channel thing, and I was just like, whoa.
It was on right after Urusei Yatsura 2, if I recall correctly.
Mm. And I think the day after, I watched the second movie, which wasn't as good as the first movie, but still awesome. And it always seems to have this message of, you know, cyborg people, you know, it's better to be a normal human because cyborg people are, like, immortal, and thus, you know, what's the point of living if you're going to live forever, blah, 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 you know. And then you always have pity on the normal people who are, like, revolting against the robot.
But then you have pity on the robot people who are, like, tragic and immortal.
Yeah, because the robot people actually are still people. So it's like when they die, you're still also kind of like, you know, but this one seems to be a little less in that direction and more in the everyone is people direction, you know, because I remember the Galaxy Express, you just like outright, the cyborgs are bad, the humans are good. And like the kid's mom, like it starts out with this kid's mom being like hunted by a robot guy as if she was like a deer. And then he like hangs her on his wall and stuff. And it's like, oh, robots are bad. This one is much less that, which I think is good because it kind of shows you that the whole universe isn't that way. It gives you a new perspective on the what's going on.
Now, don't be turned off by the fact that there's a steam-powered locomotive in space.
Oh, of course not.
That's just kind of, that's like a symbol of the show. There's this galactic train.
Mm-hmm.
And just go with it. Suspension of disbelief. The show's cool and worth it. Don't look at that like some people looked at Escaflowne's long noses and say, oh, I can't watch this.
Yeah, they actually explain the train in many places and such. And the train is actually really cool. And if you watch Galaxy Express, you'll learn all about the train. And
yeah, Galaxy Express 999 is an incredible movie. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it highly.
Yeah, so it's like for people who've already seen or know about this universe, read the manga, saw their shows, the train is like this symbol of like awesomeness. So just having a show with the train in it is like, oh, there's the train, oh my god. You know, and they already know all this other stuff about it. You know, like, if you watch this show and you've never seen any of it before, you'll see, like, the conductor. And he just comes on and he conducts. He seems perfectly normal. But if you know the conductor, it's like, whoa.
So I guess, I mean, this is kind of obscure anime that most people, it's very, definitely not mainstream.
Definitely not mainstream.
I mean, it's not up there with the Narutos.
Mainstream in Japan.
Yes. But especially for people out there who might not know a lot about anime, I can't recommend this stuff enough. It's very neat, very cerebral. It's good stuff.
Mm-hmm. And as long as you, I mean, the order in which the series go in might be complex, but as long as you watch all the series themselves in their order, it doesn't really matter which ones you watch when. I mean, there are prequels that came out after sequels and OAVs and movies. And
yeah.
Just watch as much as you can, and it'll all fit together, and it'll be enjoyable.
And if you need a good starting point, I'd, once again, Galaxy Express 999.
Yep, the first movie is definitely a great starting point. All right.
So you picked up some comics, too.
I went to the comic book store today. Let's look in this little bag here and see what I bought.
Ooh, Midtown Comics.
Oh, that's the one I'm going to save for last.
So, okay, it better be good.
I think it's good. There's a story behind it.
Though while he's digging out, since Media Play is going out of business, I picked up all the rest of Here's Greenwood at a steep discount.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like that manga.
They also have a great cheap toys going down at Media Play.
Yeah.
So if you like toys, that's a great place to go. All right, so the first thing I bought was this Gravity Digest, which the comic book podcast guys were really hyping it up. Now, I had seen this in the comic book store before they hyped it up, and I was waiting for them to put it all in one book because I wasn't going to buy five comic books of some, it just looks like some normal superhero guy, kind of generic.
I see a superhero flying with an arm outstretched.
Yep. Now, that will make you kind of feel kind of eh if you're like us and you don't like superheroes so much, or at least generic superhero stories. However, this actually surprised the hell out of me.
Really?
I read it just because they told me to, and it was only $8. So for a whole book of comics, that's a great deal, because normally one comic book is $3. This is like five or six comic books, so hell yeah. And, you know, first off, it's a story about this kid who has superpowers of gravity. And he can fly, and he can hit strong, and do anything, you know, it's basically generic superpowers. But he's pretty strong. He can kick the shit out of things and beat people up and all kinds of good stuff. All
right.
And, you know, his origin is a simple, generic origin. Oh, he was on a boat and he got sucked into a vortex and it gave him gravity powers. Whatever. The story starts where he goes to college at NYU, leaving the Hickville of Wisconsin. And it's more a story about him in NYU and in New York City, managing his life as, you know, in the aspects of grades, girlfriend, friends in general, and superheroing at night, not getting enough sleep. So if you like stories, or if you're about to go to college, or if you're in college, or nostalgic for college, this will hit you in so many ways. I mean, literally, you see this guy, like, going out to parties and stuff, and then, you know, the girlfriend's trying to go with guys to spite him, and it's good stuff. And it's also good, the second aspect of it, is from the superhero part, is he's a total noob at superheroing. Like, it's New York, so there's real superheroes all over the place in the Marvel Universe. And you see him, like, try to help out real superheroes, and, like, go away, noob, I ain't babysitting you.
Ha!
And, like, he gets tricked, like, someone comes and is like, help, help, I can't open my car. And since he's just a noob, that's the kind of thing he handles, right? So he goes and he opens the car, and then the guy just steals it. And he's like, hey. He's like, crap, I'm a noob, I got fooled. You know, and it's about him becoming from a noob to a not noob superhero, you know, which is pretty cool. The other the thing I like about this is the sort of things that go on in the background that are hilarious. Like, if you look here, right in the beginning, there's a guy who's a hot dog vendor, but obviously there's something special about that hot dog vendor.
It's-a-me, Mario!
And he's peeing in front of a sign for the producers. it's that kind of stuff. And, like, the roommate is always playing his Nintendo DS, and that's kind of hilarious, too. You know, it's stuff like that makes it pretty cool. And also, I think, let me just check on this. Yep, it's there. The one of the guys who worked on this comic is like buddy-buddy with the guys from the Comic Geek Speak podcast. So you see, like, towards the end, the kid is searching for a male freshman from Wisconsin at NYU on his computer. And you see one of the people on the list is one of the guys from the comic book podcast. His name is in there because he's from Wisconsin. It's pretty cool if you like college or New York, because they like mention all these NYU buildings and stuff, and they get blown up. And so if you're at NYU, this is just great for you to read because you'll be laughing it up. Next, all right, the second thing I bought was Preacher Volume 4. I think I already talked about Preacher.
Yeah, you did. I still have to start reading that.
Yeah, I was a little confused because this one had different artists. But actually, they should have told me this, but I would have bought it anyway. It's not in the continuity of the story. It was a side story about one of the not main characters. But I'm still good. I have yet to read it, but it's probably really cool. But just so you know that... if you don't want to read Preacher Volume 4, you can skip Volume 4, although I wouldn't recommend it because I think it's pretty cool, and it has a different artist. Third thing I brought was Testament Number 1, which is by my buddy Rushkoff. Now, when I say this, knowing you, Rim, I think you're really going to like it.
Oh, really?
And not in a Penny Arcade way, in a real way. Basically, it starts off, it's supposed to be a modern open source Bible telling, right? And it starts off with a comic book telling of the story of Abraham bringing his son Isaac up the mountain and all that stuff, right? And then immediately, they kind of put that on top of a story about a kid, a dad sending his son to the draft, you know? Like, huh. Oh, sacrificing the son? Sacrificing the son. Ooh.
And I like you go, ooh, whenever something's like metaphorical or meaningful.
Yeah, it's really cool. And then there's a point where like there's a professor teaching a class, and you can tell it's Doug Rushkoff. They drew him. That's his face into the comic as the teacher. And it's a story about how like, it's sort of like, you know how now we're all worried about Big Brother? Well, this is Super Big Brother. You have these rebel kids who are dodging the draft by cutting the RFIDs out of their arms and hiding in a swimming pool in a building.
Wow. And,
yeah, it gets pretty crazy. But everything is contrasted with, you know, the Bible. But the reason that you're going to like it is because it's not the Old Testament as written. It's the Old Testament as, like, you know, the somewhat real telling of, you know, there were many, and then one God came and killed all the other ones. And, you know, the real, somewhat archaeological, historical type.
I'm real big on that, like, pre-Christian, pre-monotheism Judaic mythology. Like,
yep.
Real big.
So that's what this is. I'm probably going to buy all the rest of them, and then if there's a trade, I'll probably buy all those. And,
well, good, because then I'll borrow them all from you. And
yeah, as long as they keep it up. I mean, Doug Rushkoff is, like, you know, the amazing writer of writing. So, and, oh, the cover is just great because it shows this guy, like, he has his hand, like, kind of, like, almost in a fist. Like, his fingers are clenched, but not a fist. And, you know, if you look at, I've only seen the picture in, like, a thumbnail on the internet before I bought it. So it looked like a guy, like, you know, there's a big bright light. So it looked kind of like a Bible pose. But then you realize he's cutting this RFID out of his arm. And it's like, oh, huh. It's a combo.
This sounds pretty cool.
Yep. Now, the last thing I bought is a very large $30 book. So the only reason I bought it for $30, well, one of the reasons I bought it was because I spent over $100 today, which means I get $20 in store credit. So it was a $10 book for me. Now, you might be aware that, you know, there are the Grammys for music, the Oscars for movies, comic books, and other graphic storytelling, graphic novels and things have the Eisner Awards, right? Now, the Eisner Awards are not for Michael Eisner, the Disney guy. And, you know, I never really knew who they were for. I just knew there was a guy named Eisner who must have done some great comics, but, you know, I didn't really know. That man is Will Eisner, and he apparently wrote, like, the comics of all comicdom, and I haven't read a damn one.
Well, considering that I have no idea what you're talking about, I haven't read any either.
Well, the Eisner Awards are like the Grammys of comic books. And every year they give them out to, like, the best comics and graphic novels and things. And if something wins an Eisner Award, it's usually not going to be some Marvel superhero book. It's usually, like, a real serious graphic novel of quality, you know? And every year you'll see that there's one Eisner Award for, like, best imported foreign material. And things like Buddha will win that, you know? So that's why you don't see them bringing over multiple awesome mangas in the same year, because they want to spread the Eisner Awards to everything that deserves it. You know, they're thinking about that sort of thing. But the Eisner Awards are because of Will Eisner, who pretty much was the first person to make serious graphic novels.
Huh.
And they're mad high quality. One of them that I don't have that I'm going to get is actually about, you know, what was that? The Elders of Zion whole thing, you know, with the Jewish conspiracy thing. He made a whole graphic novel about that, and I forget what it's called, but if you see the cover of it, you'll probably recognize it. Like, I saw the cover, and I was like, oh, that thing! I know that cover, you know, but I didn't actually know what it was until I read about it, because I wanted to know, you know, now that I'm doing more comics, I want to know what it's about. But anyway, I saw on the list of things that were coming out this week, Will Eisner, The Contract with God Trilogy. And it's apparently, like, the amazing work of his. The legendary novel and sequels that launched a new art form.
I think you referred to it earlier today when you were telling me what you're going to talk about on the show, that this is like the Citizen Kane of comics.
If it's not the Citizen Kane of comics, it sure as hell looks like it's supposed to be. You know, great enough to have the important awards named after him.
All right.
There's a quote by Scott McCloud on the
back.
Oh,
God.
He says, Will Eisner is the heart and mind of American comics.
Huh? I guess he said something intelligent for once.
Yeah.
Though apparently I mean, that guy was actually, he said a lot of good things, and it's only recently that he's been kind of, on the webcomics.
Yeah.
We'll get into him someday. If you read Penny Arcade, you know what that's all about.
Yeah, we just agree with Penny Arcade, well, because we like Penny Arcade, and we don't like Scott McCloud's comics. They're not funny or interesting to us. So we just, I guess by default, side with whatever Gabe and Tycho say.
Well, plus, I mean, basically to sum up, Scott McCloud is an advocate of, among other things, micropayments.
Boo.
And paying for comics online. And we're of the mind that things like this podcast and things like Penny Arcade should be free.
Yeah, I mean, if I can spend all this time making this podcast and I don't ask for any money, and some guy who draws a webcomic occasionally shouldn't be asking for any money. I mean, come on, man. Get with the times. And don't tell me that you need to ask for money to make it big, because Penny Arcade, you lose. They're loaded. They give the comic away for free.
And you know what? Not even just them. Mega Tokyo, all the big comics.
Yeah.
8-Bit Theater makes a lot of money.
So just because you're pissed off that the way they decided worked and the way you decided didn't work, don't keep claiming that they're doing it wrong. Just fess up.
Yeah, but we got off onto a little tangent there. We'll cover him in more detail someday.
Yep.
But I guess to close out, we got one little meta bit. Readership, well, I guess listenership, is growing, even though many of you aren't using the feed, you're just going to the website, which is fine, because that's what I do.
Mm.
But, tell your friends, we're kind of getting to that critical mass point, and I could see the show exploding if we get a little bit of word of mouth.
Yeah, so if you go to any forums online besides ours, you know, just post a little link, especially if something we said in the podcast is relevant to a discussion. Be like, hey, these guys in their podcast episode something-something talked about this. Go listen to it.
Of course, if you don't like us, don't do that.
If you don't like us, why are you still listening? You know, but, yeah, also, if you're not in our forums, go to our forums, frontrowcrew.com/forum.
They're actually really rocking.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you like listening to this stuff, then I have to only assume that you have something to say about it, or at least you're thinking, you know, or giving a nod, you know.
Because we know you're out there. We see how many of you download the episode, and we see how many people are in the forums.
Yeah.
And one of the numbers is a lot smaller than the other number.
And there's no way that we could be so uncontroversial as to where everyone listening is just nodding in agreement and has nothing contradictory or interesting to say or anything to add at all, because,
yeah,
you know.
Well, we got, well, I mean, recently the biggest thing I've seen in the forum that is kind of adversarial toward us is all of our scientific friends yelling at us about our description of viruses and how they work.
Great.
So if you want to see people make fun of us, go to our forums.
Yeah, because, you know, we're so all-knowing and we're so correct all the time that no one could possibly have anything to add or contradict anything we ever say on this podcast.
No, in fact, did you realize that I am indeed an almighty god? Ruler of all things.
Then why is it that my face appears in this comic where he's trying to depict God telling Abraham what
because
to do?
Because, you see, I made it appear to be your face so that you would think that you were God when in actuality it is me.
What kind of plan is that? What kind of crappy God are you?
You know what? That's the same kind of God who would plant fossils to trick people and make a young universe but put light already in transit so you'd think the universe was older than it really was.
That's the same kind of God who would put a pleasure dome in the middle of a waste disposal pipe.
All right. And that was Geek Nights with Rim and Scott. Special thanks to DJ Pretzel for the opening music.
Thanks for listening. Please remember to point your favorite podcatcher at feeds.feedburner.com/geeknights to get the latest episodes as soon as they're released. Also, please visit our website at www.frontrowcrew.com for the latest updates and forum discussions. And whether you love or hate our podcast, we won't know unless you send your feedback to us at geeknights@gmail.com.